Welcome back to the Atomic Hobo. Before we go on, let me apologise for my voice. I've had a bad cold this week and my voice has gone very hoarse. If you're a newcomer to the podcast, I can assure you I don't always sound like this. This week we're looking at dog tags. They are metal ID badges worn by soldiers so their bodies can be identified if they're killed in battle. But what does that have to do with nuclear war? Well, there was a scheme in America in the 1950s to get all the little kids wearing one so that their bodies could be identified by their parents after a nuclear attack. Well, the campaign surrounding the dog tags didn't ever say that, obviously. This was cheery, homely, apple pie America of the 1950s. So it was never specifically stated, hey mom and pop, sling one of these round little Junior's neck so he can claim his charred remains. Instead, the authorities framed it as a sensible civil defence precaution to keep kids nice and safe and organised, without specifically saying why it was needed. Of course, everyone knew why, but then if everyone knows, then you can spare yourself the horrific details. You can leave it all unsaid. Although arguably that's even worse, because leaving it unsaid creates a vacuum which people can fill with their horrible fears. So we'll look at the dog tag scheme in America. It wasn't unique to America, of course. Other countries issued them. West Germany, Sweden, for example. Britain had a silly little flirtation with the idea. And we'll go inside a mortuary to look at the plans for dealing with these bodies after nuclear war. So you've got yourself a pile of bodies, all neatly identifiable with their little aluminium tags. But what now? This is the Atomic Hobo, and I'm Julie McDowell. Tend to look back at the 50s as an era when everything was rosy and wholesome. I suppose it's inevitable the 50s would have this special sheen, as it was the decade when the war was over and Europe, Western Europe at least, was free again. It must have been especially nice in America, where they enjoyed a huge post-war boom. But let's not forget the real 1950s, the dreadful conformity, the polio, the tuberculosis, the newly created nuclear threat. The Americans were able to enjoy a few years where they were the only country on earth with the bomb. You've got the bomb and you've got a ton of money, so you're in charge. And then, out of nowhere, those pesky commies announce that they have it too. Suddenly, all that cash and all that sunny security doesn't seem so great. There's a threat now, and it casts a chilly shadow over the USA. Arguably, the rest of us were used to living in a chilly shadow. After all, most of Europe had been occupied, and British cities had been blitzed again and again and again, with the Nazis just over the channel, waiting to invade us. But America must have seemed so safe and removed from it all. And then to have the Soviets suddenly announce that they had the bomb too, and they had bombers which could deliver it, that must have been a shock. In this episode, we'll look at one aspect of the American response to this new atomic threat, issuing dog tags to their children so that if the Soviets did attack, the bodies of the children, probably burned or crushed beyond recognition, could be identified and returned to their parents. The tags had a less sinister purpose too. In the chaos after an atomic attack, children might become separated from their parents, or they might be off at school when the strike occurs. Having a sturdy stainless steel tag around the neck, giving name, date of birth and address, would help get the kids, whether alive, dead or injured, back to their parents. Assuming the parents were alive to receive them, of course. If the notion of Identifying people after a nuclear war and returning them back to their homes seems silly. Remember that these tags were issued in the 50s, which was still the atomic era. And the atomic bomb is far different from the hydrogen bomb, or thermonuclear bomb, which came later. They're chalk and cheese, really. The thermonuclear bomb brings inconceivable destruction, whereas the atomic bomb, well, there was the notion that an atomic war could be survivable. And so there was a possibility, yes, that frightened little kids could be reunited with panicked parents. It wasn't silly to think that there would be nice ladies with clipboards organising all the little children, grubby with ash, their little tags clinking as they shivered in the drafty school gym, waiting for mom and pop to collect them.
Dum, dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He ducked and covered, ducked and covered.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you.
Duck and cover.
School was where 1950s American children learned how to respond to the nuclear threat. At home, if a family were following civil defence advice, Dad would be digging a shelter in the back garden, and Mum would be keeping the larder stocked with the proper supplies and making sure she had first aid skills to tend to her family if needed. School supplemented this by teaching kids what to do if they heard the siren. Famously, they were taught to duck and cover, as we heard in the intro tune to this section. During a drill, the teacher would shout for the kids to drop, and they'd hunker under their desks, crouched in a ball, with their hands protecting the back of the neck and head. Or they'd all file down to the school basement or into a central corridor and crouch against the walls. It was often assumed that an attack would happen during the day when the children were at school. And of course, being 1950s America, this meant the family would be separated at that crucial moment. Dad would be off at work in the city, Mum would be at home in the suburbs in the kitchen, and the children would be off at school. So it seemed apt that the school play their part in teaching the children how to react if it happened. Psychological surveys of American children which probed into their nuclear anxieties often showed that children were deeply troubled by the thought of the bomb dropping while they were at school, and so they would be away from the perceived safety of home and mother. One method of combating that fear, on the part of both the parents and the children, was to give the children dog tags so they could be identified. You could send your child off to school in that dreadful nuclear shadow and perhaps draw some comfort from the fact that the government, those sensible men in charge, had a scheme in place to identify your child if they got lost or evacuated or injured or worse in a nuclear attack. Your child would have a government-issued stainless steel tag around the neck, turning them into a little warm package which could be safely returned to you. You had quite literally stamped your child with name and address. Those parents who were Catholic might even have subconsciously drawn some comfort from the act of placing a chain around their child's neck. I was raised as a Catholic and I was always having religious medals around my neck to bring some kind of blessing or charm or luck. These ranged from a plain gold crucifix, covering all your bases, to a medal associated with a particular patron saint. My sister, for example, had bad eczema as a child, and she was given a medal associated with Saint Rita. Saint Rita, of course, is the patron saint of skin complaints. And I'm sure my gran drew some comfort and reassurance by placing St. Rita's medal round my sister's neck. That will help your eczema. So maybe there was the same kind of comfort to be drawn in placing these chains and tags round the neck of your child. It doesn't come from St. Rita, It comes from the government. It's official. It's a recognised and endorsed civil defence scheme. Maybe you could take some comfort from that, or some reassurance. Here's a clip from a civil defence film showing children being issued with their dog tags in Nevada.
My name is Tony Earle, and I'm a senior in the Las Vegas High School. We kids here today have been asked by the government to meet with the local press, and who are going to cover the big atomic shot here, and make the announcement that all the kids in Las Vegas are going to be tagged with a metal identification tag. This right here is the metal identification tag that we are urging every child and teenager in America to wear as soon as possible. We hope we never have to use these tags. We hope we never have an attack here. But as we are the closest people in America to the atomic explosions, well, we know a little bit of how important the wearing of these can be.
The USA, of course, didn't have one single scheme operating across the whole nation. Different states and different school districts ran their own schemes. So you had some cities where every kid had a nice stainless steel dog tag, and some where nothing was provided, and it was up to the parents to buy one privately if they wanted. New York City was probably the most prodigious in terms of dishing out dog tags to the children. The New York Times reported in October 1951 that 200,000 children had been given dog tags at school, all marked with name, address, date of birth, school, and parents' name. They were to be worn at all times, either on the neck or the wrist. The paper reported that protesters said it was, quote, promoting war hysteria among school children. The officials held it is better to be safe than sorry. The Washington Post reported that some tags were stamped also with the child's religion, for example, P for Protestant. This was in case they were found dead and could then be given an appropriate burial. This is again a reminder that we are in the atomic age here. In the dreadful thermonuclear age, there was no possibility of giving someone the dignity of an individual burial in line with their religious beliefs. It would just be a case of mass graves where everyone is tossed in together. If indeed there is anything to throw into the grave and you haven't simply been vaporised. Speaking of being vaporised, that's why the tags, of course, were usually made of stainless steel to withstand heat. But steel and the chain needed to hold it around the neck is expensive. So some areas gave out plastic tags. Pennsylvania must have been going through hard times as, according to the Washington Post, they issued cardboard tags during the Cuba crisis. Of course, Britain issued cardboard tags to its children when they were being evacuated in the Second World War. But there was no fear of them being incinerated by temperatures hotter than the sun. Now we're talking about America, so let's look at the cost. The New York Times said that New York City had a budget for dog tags in their civil defence school spending, so they were able to issue the tags free. San Francisco did likewise. On the other hand, Denver and Detroit, for example, had no budget for this and so advised parents to perhaps sew a little label inside their kids' clothing. In Philadelphia, you could buy one in your local shop and get it engraved, but it was up to you to do that and up to you to pay for it. The authorities looked at alternatives to dog tags. They are expensive, as we've discussed, if they're done properly as steel. And they have an obvious and gruesome military connection, which isn't desirable when we're talking about children. So what else could they do to ensure that the kids were identifiable after an attack? The Civil Defence Staff College met in Maryland in 1951 to consider other options. This is what they came up with. Quote, tattooing is considered occasionally, but generally rejected because of its associations and impermanence in the case of severe burns. Marking of clothing is more seriously regarded, but clothing can be destroyed and is frequently interchanged. Fingerprinting is regarded by some as an infringement of privacy. Cards are easily worn out, stolen, or destroyed. So it seemed a chain around the neck was the best bet, although the idea of tattooing citizens did pop up again. Chicago suggested a scheme whereby all citizens would have their blood type tattooed below the armpit. There was no point tattooing it on the arm, where you might usually put a tattoo, because limbs can be blown off in a nuclear blast. Best to keep it snug and hidden under the armpit. If you have children, you might think there's no need to have ID attached to them. You'll know that if they're lost and bored and hungry and far from home and starting to get tetchy and irritable, they'll be screaming and yelling and demanding that mum come and get them. So there'll be no need to check who they are, because they'll be very forthright in telling you and asking for their parents to come and get them. So as long as they're alive and well, they'll tell you. Ah, but what about this? In the archives in Edinburgh, I found some discussions between doctors and civil defence staff where they said that even in the aftermath of nuclear war, even in the midst of all that chaos, they must still have a process for certifying the dead. You can't just haul the corpses into a pit. You must allow a doctor to examine them and certify them as dead. But why bother? They've just been nuked. Quite sure they're dead? Well, not quite. The notes I found said, quote, "Some means of certification may be necessary, especially where deeply shocked people can appear to be dead." I find that horrifying. The fact that you could be so shocked and stunned by the nuclear attack that you appear to be dead. And so you risk being dragged into a mass grave and buried alive. So medical people were saying, no, put the brakes on here. We can't just assume that all those people we find after the attack are dead. We must take the time to examine each body and certify the death. And to do that, you of course need some means of identification. So for that reason alone, the idea of dog tags and ID is important if we're going to have a proper process of certifying the dead and making sure people aren't buried alive. Again, however, we can assume that this call for careful certification of the dead soon vanished when the hydrogen bomb made itself known. You'll notice that I talk about mass graves or pits. My first episode was called Disposal of the Dead, and that talked about plans to bury us all in mine shafts or tipping us into the sea. So the idea is always tip them somewhere, bury them somewhere, get them underground or underwater. You might wonder though, wouldn't it be easier just to burn the bodies? Well, not according to Dee Garrison's great book, Bracing for Armageddon. She says that mortuary staff, when dealing with corpses after a nuclear attack, were told to wear lead-lined clothing because they'd be dealing with contaminated corpses. Those bodies are effectively radioactive waste, and so cremation is not advisable, because burning the bodies would release radioactive particles into the air through the smoke. Burial is therefore the safest option. As it is with ordinary nuclear waste from a plant, you bury it, you don't burn it. Garrison also said that mortuary staff should be told to permit grieving families to view the body, but only if they are not allowed to linger too long. That's a reminder, of course, that their relative's body is now a contaminated item which has to be disposed of. And what about Britain? It never really got organised on issuing ID tags. There was the natural British aversion to such a scheme. We don't have a system of ID cards in this country, for example. And there was also lots of silly, petty, bureaucratic bickering about it. They couldn't decide, for example, what to put on the tags. Britain's proposed scheme would have been for everyone, not just school children, so the idea of putting school and parents' name on it was useless, of course. So it was suggested that we set up a system of ID numbers. Oh, but that would be far too time-consuming. So it was suggested that we print the person's national insurance number on the tag. Oh, but not everyone has one, of course. Children don't have one, for example. Well, what if we put the person's name and address? Ah, but what if evacuation is then instigated and so the address is suddenly meaningless? There was also lots of complaining about the cost, of course. Post-war Britain was exhausted, money was short, and there was also a huge steel shortage. So the idea of Using steel to create little necklaces for everyone was not a welcome idea. So they poked around for ways of doing it on the cheap. Instead of using steel, might the discs be made out of fibre? And instead of attaching them via a metal chain, we could hang them round the neck on a nylon loop. So there was lots of meetings at the Ministry of Supply where they tried to find cheap ways of issuing ID tags. One note from the Ministry of Supply says, quote, "He asked whether we wanted something that would stand up to incineration of a body, or merely something that would still be legible if the body were charred, the clothing burnt, and the face unrecognisable. I said the former would be what was really wanted, but that the latter would do if there were insuperable difficulties in the way of the former." So wasn't that just a very British way of saying, look, can we do it cheap? We've got no money left. So the ID tag scheme in Britain was always hampered by moans about cost and convenience. I hope my sore throat hasn't invaded the podcast too much. I had a cup of tea here to help soothe it, but it has long since gone cold. Hopefully I'll be better soon as I go to London next week to appear as a guest on someone else's podcast. More news on that later. I'm also going to the British Library and Imperial War Museum while I'm there to plunder the archives for all their nuclear material. So I need to be on top form. It'll be hard work. I'll be sending postcards out to my patrons, so I'll make sure that I write you some really creepy nuclear secrets on the back that I've found in the library. Of course, I'll be putting some little snippets up on Twitter, as always. You can find me there at Julie A. McDevil, or on Facebook at Nuclear Britain. I'm also so delighted, really so pleased, to see I'm getting more and more people all the time signing up to my Patreon. Whenever I'm out with the dog, Tsar Bomba, as we know, I'll get a ping on my mobile, and it's an email saying that a new person has signed up, and it's so thrilling, it really is, because you're helping support this podcast and also all the nuclear research and travel that's going into the writing of my book. Some of my patrons will of course be mentioned in the acknowledgements section of the book and will get a free signed copy. So if you want to join my Patreon and support my nuclear work, please do take a look at patreon.com/atomichobo, where you can donate a sum each month in exchange for nuclear rewards. Or if you want to just make a one-off donation to help fund my research trip to London, you can do it via PayPal. You can go to paypal.me/atomichobo. I'm so grateful to everyone who supports my work. It's not just the money, of course, although the money, of course, is useful. It's also the fact that people out there think so well of me and what I do that they want to throw a bit of cash my way, and that is great. It really does lift my spirits. So I'm so grateful to everyone. But let me give a special shout out to the following patrons. A big thanks to Dan Breen, he's my latest patron. Also Gary Watson, Arika, Lucy Stegerwald, Jonathan Abelins, Heather Parker. Again, Heather's one of the new ones who just signed up. Thank you, Heather. Peter Mars, Tom Stickland, Yannick, Andrew Key, Sam Marco, Richard Grundy, Dave Marks, Alan Christie, Helen McHale, Douglas Greenshields, Colin McGee, Sean Milson, Brian Outlaw, Damien Ryan, Peter Lee, Bruce Armstrong, John Haynes, Eamon Coyle, Julie Eek, Sarah Brassington, Nick Packham, Tara Moore, Simon Reid, Lynette Walsh, Christopher Creva, Richard Lewis, Adam Spink, Ian McCulloch, Linda Woolnough, Kevin Butcher, Simon Allison, Sean Judge, Paul Maxwell Walters, Wynne Grant, Ben Capper, Mary Freer, Phil Catling, Steve Sace, Claire Brennan, Paul Jonathan Viner, and Gordon McNair. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to have a cup of tea now, get this voice sorted out. But thank you all for listening. Thank you all for your support. And if you could maybe help me by leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you find the podcast, that's also a great way of helping me. And I'll be back next week, hopefully with a clearer voice and some more nuclear horror. Bye for now.